Speaking of money and counting, did you know that there's only three kinds of people in the world? You can categorize them all. People who can count and people who can't. So everybody fits there. Ecclesiastes 5 is where we'll find our text tonight, starting at verse 8. If you want to be turning there, verse 10 says, "He who loves money will not be satisfied with money, nor he who loves wealth with his income. This also is vanity." So we're going to see tonight the vanity of trusting in wealth. Behind me you see a picture now of a famous painting, The Money Lender and His Wife. This is hung at the Louvre in Paris. I've been there. I can't honestly say that I remember this painting, but I did see the Mona Lisa. This is by the Renaissance artist Quentin Massais. It's a famous painting, confronts us with the choice that everybody here has to make, everybody on the planet has to make, really, between God and money. The money lender is sitting at home with a measuring scale next to him, a pile of money in front of him on the table, carefully assessing the value, however, at this moment, of a single one of those coins. Yet our eye is also drawn to the woman sitting next to him, the money lender's wife. She's leafing through her Bible or a book there of spiritual exercises, which presumably was bought for her by her wealthy husband. So she's having her devotions. She's wanting to get closer to God, except she's distracted. She's distracted by that money right there in front of her as he counts it. So as she turns the page, her gaze is captivated by the coin that would easily distract her. And Massais painted this image to make a serious point. His adopted city of Antwerp had become a world power in his day for business and trade. But Massais saw how easily money can pull our souls away from the worship of God. He saw it all around him. So that's really the ultimate point of this painting. All of us feel this tension. We know that God demands our highest allegiance. We believe that nothing is more precious for those of us who are gathered here tonight. That's good, Nate. But the message of the gospel. The gospel is what changes. The gospel is what transforms. And yet, like that wife, we're all too easily distracted by money. Sometimes we'd rather thumb through a mail order catalog of objects that we could purchase, things we could have, than to have our own devotion, if we're really honest with ourselves. Well, Solomon wants to speak to us about that. The vanity of injustice is first on his plate here in verse 8. He wants us to win this spiritual struggle and wants us to understand the foolishness of trusting in anything other than God. He starts by talking about the injustice that money brings, the love of money, the desire for money in among people all around us. Look what he says in verse 8. "If you see in a province the oppression of the poor and the violation of justice and righteousness, do not be amazed at the matter. For the high official is watched by a higher, and yet there are higher ones over them." He's talking about the structure of government, how there always seem to be more and more layers of government, don't there? I mean, government's never satisfied with just one official, with just one layer of bureaucracy. We need more and more and more. At every turn, what intends to be good can turn out to be injustice. We can see that in communism, where the state seizes control of the means of production, but of course we also see it in capitalism. Whenever profit is pursued without regard for the well-being of other people, it can be a tool to manipulate and to abuse those lower on the socioeconomic strata than you or I. So Ecclesiastes is just be honest. It's just telling the truth about this world that we live in. He's not rejoicing in that fact. He's bemoaning that fact. He's sad about that fact. He's just being realistic about how government can be used either for profit of the people or for the downtrodden of those people's hearts and lives. There are so many kinds of injustice in society that Solomon is saying we should never be surprised by sin. "Unless there is some Solomon," Martin Luther wrote, "to exhort and console, government crushes the man, extinguishes him, and utterly destroys him." Verse 9 continues this thought. It offers at least a partial solution to this perennial problem. The preacher says, "But this is gain for a land in every way, a king committed to cultivated fields." That was a very hard word to translate, actually, in the Hebrew. The way the ESV has it here, the best defense against government corruption is a godly king. Your version may not say that same exact thing, but Solomon is saying that society needs rulers who have wisdom, who look for the best among the people. That's what it means by these cultivated fields. Of course, our experience with injustice in this fallen world leads us actually to expect corruption at every turn, not just among the people out there, but the people in here, the people in our own hearts, the people that we wake up with every day. Now, there are some leaders who are motivated by a pure desire to serve society, and they're elected and they're placed in different offices, and that's a wonderful thing. But many others are like the notorious Philadelphia politician who used public funds to sustain his own lavish lifestyle, buying all sorts of gifts, and his wife used the public credit cards, and then he boasted to his friends about spending other people's money. Yeah, we've seen that a little closer to home in our own culture around us as well, and among government officials that have been caught living off of your dime and off of my dime. The best governments assume from the outset that people are sinners. And our founding fathers understood this, and that's the reason they built in the list of checks and balances. Why? Because they trusted people? No, because they didn't trust people, and they knew themselves too well. But even the best governments are far from perfect. As long as we live on this earth, Solomon is telling us, we should expect to see people buying their way to power, using public position for their own gain, and manipulating the system to their own advantage. I'm reminded of one of Ronald Reagan's most famous quips when he said the nine most scary words in the English language: "I'm from the government and I'm here to help you." That should make any of us quiver in our boots. Rather than looking for the government to solve our problems, we need to acknowledge that even the best rulers fall well short of perfection. Therefore, we live with a hope for a better government. A government we celebrate at this time of the year, obviously, that Isaiah promises in Isaiah 9, "For unto us a child is born, and unto us a son is given, and the government will be upon his shoulders, and his name will be called Wonderful Counselor, Mighty God, Everlasting Father, and Prince of Peace." So he speaks to us about the vanity of injustice. Second, he speaks to us about the vanity of prosperity in verse 10. He's been talking about wealth and poverty on the national scale, but here in verse 10, he gets like a preacher, a little bit too personal. He starts, instead of just talking about don't steal, he starts telling us don't steal watermelons, and that hurts. Public officials aren't the only people who want to get more money. It's a temptation for all of us. So the preacher warns us about the vanity of prosperity in verse 10. "He who loves money will not be satisfied with money, nor he who loves wealth with his income. This also is vanity." Would you be happy if instead of giving a partial tax break to you, the government just said, "Don't worry about that thing called taxes. We're good. We don't need any of your money from now on"? Would you be happy in 2018? I wonder. Many people would. They'd say, "Yeah, I'm happy now. I'm good." But would you be happy with that extra amount of money? And then could you say to your spouse, to your children, or your grandchildren, "I never need anything else. I'm good. I'm content. I never need another thing"? See, we set up these false assumptions in our mind. Just a little bit more will make us happy. That's what John D. Rockefeller, when asked how much money would ever make him happy, that's what he said: $1 more. Well, that's a fool's game at its heart. The contemporary author Jesse O'Neill has diagnosed this spiritual problem. She calls it in the New York Times affluenza, which is an unhealthy relationship with money, she calls it, or the pursuit of wealth. Most Americans have at least a mild case of that. We have affluenza of this deadly disease of love of pursuit of money. I mean, it inflicts all of us, even if we're thankful for what we have, even if most of the time we're content. That evil monster of discontent will arise from our hearts, make us look askance at somebody else who gets the promotion, somebody else who gets the raise, somebody else who drives a newer car, and all the rest. The appetite for what money can buy is never satisfied. The only way to curb it is to ask God's Holy Spirit to give us His matchless gift of contentment. Charles Bridges said that when our desires are running ahead of our needs, it's better for us to sit down content where we are than where we hope to be in the delusion of our insatiable desire. In other words, rather than always craving more, just to rest in the Lord and trust in the Lord for the provision that He has and to be satisfied with God. That's a long struggle for all of us. It's a lifelong struggle for all of us. At one time, we sing along with the Beatles and we say, "I don't care too much for money." But then just like them, a few years later, they sang, "Money don't get everything, it's true. What it don't get, I can't use. Now give me money. That's what I want." And we're just like them. At one moment, we're thinking, "Yeah, I'm good." And then at the next moment, we're singing along with Madonna, "This is a material world, and I'm a material girl," or guy, as the case may be. Ecclesiastes warns our divided hearts that living for the things that only money can buy is true vanity. What are the problems with money? Well, he begins to discuss them. First problem with money is that other people will try to take it from us. That's the reason you have locks on your doors and bars on your windows and all the rest of it, because the thieves want to break in. They want to rob. They want to steal. Verse 11 says, "When goods increase, they increase who eat them. And what advantage has their owner but to see them with his eyes?" The phrase of "those who increase and eat them" refers in some way to those who consume what you take in. Might be the oppressive government through high taxes. It might be those who come along and are dependent upon us. Maybe the hungry mouths at our table, but they always multiply to other people who are freeloaders or the hangers-on or the spongers or those who just think, "Whatever you have is mine and I'll take it." And we see that in the evening news at every turn. No one knew this better than King Solomon. He was the richest man during his day in the world, but given the many thousands of people that he had to feed, you can read about that in 1 Kings 4, he almost needed to be that wealthy. Here he warns us that the more we have, the more people will want it. They'll covet what we have. And if they eventually succeed in getting it, we'll never be able to enjoy it ourselves. We may see it, but like this man, it'll be gone before we ever get the chance to use it. That, Solomon says, is vanity. Secondly, problem with having more money is it will keep us up at night. The preacher King makes this point by drawing a contrast in verse 12. "Sweet is the sleep of a laborer, whether he eats little or much. But the full stomach of the rich will not let him sleep." He's not just talking about the evening meal that he gorged on, although that might be, you know, a cause for indigestion. He's talking about the more that you have, the more you worry about it, the more you toil over it. You just want to make sure you don't lose a cent of it in the stock market or in your investments or in your IRA or anything else. As a general rule, people who work hard all day, especially if they work with their hands, are ready for a good night's sleep, whether they have a decent supper or not, Solomon says. But the idle rich do not enjoy that luxury, even of a good night's sleep, because their money becomes a worry for them. It brings about insomnia. Having a lot of money can be very unhealthy, not just spiritually, but also physically. So people who work hard should count their blessings, even if they can't always count on a big fat paycheck. They can be grateful, as Solomon says here, for manual labor. But the lifestyle of the very wealthy and the rich and the lazy tends not to be restful like that. He speaks of the vanity of injustice. He speaks of the vanity of prosperity. And third tonight, he speaks of the vanity of temporary prosperity. Thus far, Solomon's been talking about the vanity of having a lot of money. In verses 13 and 14, he talks about the vanity of losing it. "There is a grievous evil that I have seen under the sun. Riches were kept by their owner to his hurt, and those riches were lost in a bad venture. And he is the father of a son, but he has nothing in his hand." This is the third reason why living for money is meaningless. It may be here today, but you turn around and it's gone tomorrow. The preacher calls this a grievous evil, which literally means it makes him sick to even think about it. To explain why, he gives us a case study, the point at which, Martin Luther says, is to show that God permits the very riches in which people trust to bring about the ruin of those who own them. There's a distaste and there's a disaster that goes along with money that only those who have it experience. The story Solomon tells concerns a wealthy man who tried to hoard his wealth, yet he lost it all in some risky investment. Today, people that do that in gambling or they do it in the stock market, in those days, their ships foundered at sea, or the camel trains were attacked in the wilderness by robbers. But whatever the reason, this man took a gamble and ended up destitute as a result. He has nothing in his hand. Even worse, he says, the man was a father, and now he had nothing to leave his son. And this story thus assumes what the Bible teaches in other places, that parents should leave a legacy for their children. But don't be quick to correct me afterwards and say, now, Brother Todd, I thought the Bible was against money. How come he's talking so much about leaving a big wealth, you know, a big stack of money for your children? That's the exact opposite of what he's saying. He's talking about the spiritual wealth. He's talking about the spiritual value of passing that along to others. Fathers and mothers have a duty to save and sacrifice for their sons and daughters. Yet that doesn't mean getting, doesn't mean accumulating things. That's the opposite of what Solomon's point is. The whole point of this story is that counting on money is vanity and striving after the wind. Instead of what he's saying is, you and I need to seek after the things that are first, as Jesus would tell us in Matthew chapter 6. Now, most of you get to experience this on a weekly or a monthly or, you know, very frequent basis. This is the first time, I believe, in about 15 or 16 years that my wife and I, this last Sunday, were able to experience both of our kids together with our daughter-in-law and with our granddaughter, and I almost couldn't even begin the message after experiencing, you know, a day of worship of that, but not for just, oh, I'm so proud. That's not what it was about. It was about remembering as a 15 and 16-year-old kid growing up outside of church, and I came to faith in Christ. It's beginning to remember that prayer that I prayed even before I knew who God was or who Jesus was, that whatever happened, A, God, please don't ever let me get divorced. And then praying after I became a Christian, God, whatever happens, please let me break the curse. The curse that had been passed down to me through lots of experiences and lots of turmoil and abuse in our home, and I just prayed as a 16-year-old kid, God, when I grow up, may I just break this. May I just stop this. And what you saw on stage Sunday morning was just a evidence of God answering prayers, thankfully not based upon me, but based purely upon His grace and mercy, that I would have two sons who love God with all their heart, and now a granddaughter who, when she was talking with somebody the other day about Christmas, she said, you know, Christmas is not about Santa. Christmas, she does the Santa thing, that's fine. But she said, Christmas is not really about Santa. It's about Jesus' birthday. And I just thought, that's what this Bible verse is talking about. Having riches that this world knows nothing about that you can pass on to your children and be grateful when you see it come to pass. Then the preacher king gives us a fourth reason to resist the fevers of affluenza. The reason this time is we can't take it with us. Here is how the story of the man who lost his money continues in verse 15. As he came from his mother's womb, he shall go again. Naked as he came, and shall take nothing for his toil that he may carry away in his hand. This also is a grievous evil. Just as he came, so shall he go. And what gain is there to him who toils for the wind? The language of these verses, you can hear it, is almost simultaneous or almost identical to what Job said. After he lost everything he had in the first chapter of his book, he says, naked I came from my mother's womb, naked I shall return. The Lord gave and the Lord has taken away. Blessed be the name of the Lord. Or in the words of the Apostle Paul, he took the same truth and applied it to all of us. In 1 Timothy 6, we brought nothing into the world and we can take nothing out of the world. One day all of our labors, all of our striving will be over. And thus the tragic reality that Solomon reminds us of is that everybody must face this truth. We are mortal. We don't go on forever. So all this stuff we accumulate, all the profit that we build up, we can't do anything with it at that moment. At the end of one of his most profitable years on the European tour, someone asked several years ago the English golfer Simon Dyson, if there was anything that he was afraid of. And he quickly answered, death. He said, I'm in a position now where I can pretty much do as I want with all my money, but dying would not be good right now. Well, I wonder if he's thought about it since then, would it be good now? I mean, is there ever a time you say, yeah, I'm pretty much good with dying today? Well, only if your heart's not set on money. Only if it's set on the right things. And whether or not we make as much money as a professional golfer, like it or not, there will come a day too for you and for me when we have to leave it all behind. Solomon tells us here we need to think about that now. We need to bank on what's truly important. Again, as Martin Luther said, as I shall forsake my riches when I die, so I shall forsake them while I am living. That's really what Solomon is saying. And one way to forsake our wealth is to simply look around at what we have and to say to ourselves, here's something that God has given me to enjoy. It's a gift from Him, but I don't trust in it. I don't rely in it. I rely and trust only in God because I'll never be able to take it with me. That's a good thing for little boys and little girls to remember when they play with their toys. It's just a toy. It's a good thing for teenagers to remember when they drive their cars and have their clothes and listen to their music. It's a good thing for men and women to remember when they have their jewels and they have their houses and they have their cars and they have their retirement income. You know what? It's just a gift from God. It's not what this life is about. I'll enjoy it. I'll be grateful for it, but we should travel light. Everything that Solomon says about money is beautifully paraphrased in one of my favorite authors' little books. Randy Alcorn wrote a book called The Treasure Principle. It's only about 35 pages long. You ought to pick it up and read it. Under the heading Chasing the Wind, he quotes each of these insights of Ecclesiastes 5, and then he adds his own paraphrase. Scripture says in verse 10, whoever loves money never has money enough. Alcorn says, the more you have, the more you want. Whoever loves wealth, in verse 10, is never satisfied with his income. Alcorn says, the more you have, the less you're satisfied. As goods increase, verse 11 says, so do those who consume them. Alcorn says, the more you have, the more people, including the government, will come after it. And then verse 11, what benefit are they to the owner except to feast his eyes on them? The more you have, the more you realize it does you no good. Verse 12, the sleep of a laborer is sweet, whether he eats little or much, but the abundance of a rich man permits him no sleep. Alcorn says, the more you have, the more you have to worry about. Verse 13, I've seen a grievous evil under the sun, wealth hoarded to the harm of its owner. Alcorn says, the more you have, the more you can hurt yourself by holding on to it. Or verse 14, wealth lost through some misfortune. The more you have, the more you have to lose. Verse 15, naked a man comes from his mother's womb, and as he comes, so he departs. He takes nothing from his labor that he can carry in his hand. Alcorn says, the more you have, the more you'll leave behind. Solomon summarizes the many reasons not to live for money in verse 17. Moreover, all his days he eats in darkness, in much vexation and sickness and anger. That's really a pathetic picture. Who's at the end of his life and he's a miser. He's built up a lot of money, but like a lot of misers, he's angry and he's unhappy. He'll end up alone in his misery because he lives in spiritual darkness. His soul is vexed with many anxieties. The ungodly pursuit of wealth takes its physical toil, leaving him in poor health. He's also very angry, a bitter old man, for who's ever heard of a happy miser? I haven't. People who live for money try to hold on to as much of it as they can, but when they have to let it go, as everyone does eventually, it creates a burning rage inside of them. That gives us a helpful question to ask about our own anger, some of which may be caused by excessive love for the things of this world. When we really get angry, what's the reason? When husbands and wives have arguments about how much to spend and for what, are they disagreeing about the principles of biblical stewardship? Or are they really fighting over who gets to spend what they want for what they desire? The unsatisfied desire for worldly possessions is one powerful producer of anger. But we don't have to rest there. Solomon next tells us about the power to enjoy. We hear this story about this angry man in Ecclesiastes 5, and we can't help but think to ourselves, well, there's got to be a better way. And Solomon says, yes, there is. The Bible tells us not to put our hope in wealth, which is uncertain, but to put our hope in God in 1 Timothy 6. Solomon put it this way in verses 18 and 19. Behold, what I've seen to be good and fitting is to eat and drink and find enjoyment in all the toil with which one toils under the sun, and a few days of his life that God has given him, for this is his lot. Everyone also to whom God has given wealth and possessions and power to enjoy them and to accept his lot and rejoice in his toil, this is the gift of God. Now this causes some scholars' head to explode at this moment. They've been reading along Ecclesiastes and everything seems to be going good. He's negative. Everything's vexation, everything's vanity, everything's terrible. And now all of a sudden he says, so enjoy it. And they just can't put A and B together. But it's only because they're ignoring Solomon's whole point. Solomon's telling us what not to trust in, and then he comes back at the end and he says, but if you trust in God, enjoy everything. Enjoy it all as a gift from his hand. The joy in working, the joy in feasting, the joy in just living. He knows that joy is real because he's experienced it himself. So as he looks back over the wrong way to live, the wrong way to work, the wrong way to eat, the wrong way to go after money, he says, you can have riches in God. You can rejoice in him. He says this because he believes in the God of joy. Both having things and enjoying things are gifts from God. They don't always go together, but they can go together in a Christian's heart. It helps us have a balanced view of our earthly possessions. The world that God created is full of many rich gifts, but the power to enjoy them comes only from him. Don't look to the hand of the giver. Don't look to the gift in the hand. Look only to him as the giver. And therefore, you can enjoy everything. You can enjoy wealth. You can enjoy family. You can enjoy friendship. You can enjoy food or work or sex or any other good gift as long as it's done according to the way that God lays it out and designs it for you and for me to enjoy. Satisfaction ultimately only comes from him and having a relationship with him in Jesus Christ. The person who learns this lesson well has good promise to him. Look at verse 20. Will not much remember the days of his life, he will, because God keeps him occupied with joy in his heart. I like that. The ultimate outcome, he says, is not disaster. The ultimate outcome is joy. He uses positive words to make a positive point about the joy that God alone can bring to the human heart. When we learn to enjoy God, we experience so much joy that life's short vanity is all but forgotten. Nate, if we could pop that picture up one more time. Asaph appears to have learned this spiritual lesson well. We know this from a striking detail in the moneylender and his wife. Remember that in this picture, both the husband and wife turn away from God to focus on their money. But notice on the table between them, Asaph cleverly paints a small round mirror which reflects a little scene that's taking place just outside the frame of the painting. If you look at the image in the mirror closely, you can see dark lines of a window frame that intersect to make the form of a cross. You can also see a small human figure reaching out for the frame, as if instead of reaching for the coin, he's reaching for the cross. And art historians tell us that face is familiar. It's Masseis himself. The artist, like the preacher King who wrote Ecclesiastes, is reminding us not to look for money to give us satisfaction in life. Instead, we're invited to reach out for the cross, where Jesus gave his life for all of our greedy sins, to hold on to Jesus and find our full satisfaction in him. Now, what questions have I left for you from this text tonight?